Hi, I'm Ken Norman. It's a pleasure to be here. And so, let's see. Over the course of the day, we've been talking about the many uses of machine learning pattern classification methods. And so Francisco and Nico and the other speakers have been talking about how we can use these methods to determine where and how information is represented in the brain. And Francisco also alluded this morning to the idea that you can use these kinds of methods to track time-varying cognitive states. So one of the themes of the day has been that multivariate methods improve our sensitivity to detect cognitive states. And one of the key benefits of this is that we can generate a useful estimate of sort of where the subject is cognitively at a particular point in time. And so what I'm going to be talking about today is how we can leverage this temporal sensitivity to test psychological theories. So just to explain what I mean by that, you know, psychological theories, theories that cognitive psychologists, cognitive neuroscientists are interested in, can at a really high sort of abstract level be viewed as if-then statements. So if the subject's in a particular cognitive state, then some outcome should occur. Like, if you cue memory in a particular way, then you'll retrieve a certain kind of memory, right? And so the standard behavioral approach to testing theories is basically to set up an experiment that you hope will bring about the cognitive state of interest in the subject, right? So you're trying to steer the subject's cognitive state in a particular way, and then look for the predicted outcome. The problem, of course, is that our ability as experimenters to control the subject's cognitive state is limited, right? So there's always going to be variance in what the subject is thinking above and beyond variance induced by the experimental manipulation, right? And so that causes a problem, because if we run an experiment and you don't get the effect that we want, right, it might be because the theory's wrong, it might be because this if-then statement is false, or it may be that we just weren't successful in steering the subject's mental state where we wanted it to go. Okay, and so our approach to dealing with this problem is to use pattern classifiers applied to different kinds of brain imaging data to isolate distributed patterns of neural activity corresponding to cognitive states of interest. And the idea is that once we've trained up a pattern classifier to detect the neural correlate of a particular cognitive state, we can use the classifier to track the comings and goings of that cognitive state over time. And we can use this time-varying readout of the subject's cognitive state to test ideas about how that cognitive state relates to behavior. And another benefit of being able to track cognitive states is that it allows us to use more open-ended, naturalistic experimental designs, right? So if we can read out where you are mentally, we don't have to try as hard to sort of clamp your cognitive state in a particular way. Okay, so here's an outline of the talk. I'm going to be presenting two case studies. The first one is a study in my lab trying to use classifiers applied to EEG data to test the theory of how brain activity drives learning. And the other one is to use classifiers applied to fMRI to track cognitive processes during memory search. And I'll also try to talk about some limitations that we've discovered of the classifier approach for answering the kinds of questions that we want to answer. Okay, and so all the studies I'm going to be talking about today have the same two-part design that we've converged on. And so in these studies, the purpose of the first part of the experiment is to collect data for classifier training. And during this first part, we try to strongly and unambiguously elicit the cognitive states of interest, right? And we're going to use these relatively clean data to train the classifier. And then the second part of the experiments, we apply the classifier that we trained on this clean data to situations where the subject's cognitive state is more variable, right? Where it floats around more, right? So there's a kind of a bootstrapping where basically we have a part of the experiment where we think we really know what's going on in the subject's head, and we get data from that part. We try to leverage it to understand what's going on in this more messy and mysterious part of the experiment. Okay. Right. And we use that to try to predict behavior. So, all right, this first study was done by my graduate student, Aaron Newman, who just finished up this year, was looking at this phenomenon called negative priming. And so the way these negative priming studies work is that you have these stimulus displays comprised of two pictures overlaid on top of one another, right, and say that one of them is always tinted red, the other one's always grayscale, and the subject's job is to attend to or make some decision about the red-tinted stimulus, right? And so the trick is, so on this display here, you're supposed to attend to this face and kind of ignore this house. And the trick is that at some time later in the experiment, we might show you one of the stimuli that you previously ignored and ask you to respond to it, right? And so the question that these studies ask is, how does ignoring the house over here affect your responding to it later? All right, and the key finding from these studies is that subjects tend to be faster to respond to stimuli that were previously attended, right? Like if we repeat these red stimuli, and slower to respond to stimuli that were previously ignored, right? Like this house, if you have to respond to it over here. Okay, and so the goal of this study, theoretically, was to test some ideas that my lab and other people have developed regarding how competition drives learning. And so the idea behind these theories is that whenever you have two representations that are competing, it is the representation that wins, that ends up being the strongest, is going to get strengthened. Representations that compete, right, that get active above baseline but lose, according to these theories, are supposed to get weakened, and representations that don't activate are supposed to not change in their strength. All right? And so to a first approximation, this seems to fit pretty well with the negative priming phenomenon, right? So the idea is you can think that you have a competition going on here between the face and the house, right? The red-tinted thing, which I'll call the target, wins, so it gets strengthened. The grayscale thing back here, which I'll call the distractor, the idea is it's going to activate a little because it's on the screen, it's coming in through your eyeballs, but it eventually will lose, right? So it'll get weakened. And then other stimuli that aren't on screen, they don't activate, so nothing happens to them, right? So it seems like it fits reasonably well. The fly in the ointment is that negative priming effects empirically are just extremely flaky, right? So there have been just as many, if not more, studies that have failed to find these effects as there are studies that have actually obtained them, right? So this poses a problem, right? So one explanation is that maybe the theory's wrong, right? So maybe representations that activate but lose the competition, they aren't weakened. Right, so this would be saying that the flaw is over here. Right, and another explanation is that maybe the theory's right, but the mapping between experimental conditions and activation dynamics is noisy. Right, so you can imagine that maybe some of these distractors activate weakly, right, but other distractors activate a lot. Right, so you might accidentally fully process the grayscale stimulus, in which case it'll win the competition, it'll be strengthened, and sometimes you just don't notice it at all. Right, in which case there'd be no change in strength. And so if we think that there's a kind of distribution of where these distractor stimuli end up in terms of how much they activate, that might explain why these effects are flaky, right? Because the effect that we want, right, basically the theory says that the region of activation space that leads to weakening is bounded on both sides by regions that either lead to strengthening or nothing. Okay. So the point of this experiment and our approach to answering this question is to use pattern classifiers to try to directly measure distractor activation on a trial-by-trial basis, and then use this measure of distractor activation to try to predict whether subjects will show positive priming, so faster reaction times, negative priming, slow reaction times, or no priming for that item. Okay, so the way the paradigm was set up, stimuli were composed of this red, so every display subject saw had one of these red-tinted target stimuli on top of a grayscale distractor. And we set up the experiment so that the pictures in these displays were either faces, houses, shoes, or chairs. And in a particular display, the target and the distractor were always from different categories. And this is very important for the way we end up doing the analysis. So on a particular trial, subjects saw this fixation cross, and then they saw this initial display, which we'll call the prime, and they're supposed to pay attention to the red-tinted stimulus. Then there was a mask. All right, and then they saw the second display, which we call the probe, and then the subject's job was to say whether the red-tinted stimulus on the probe was identical to the red-tinted stimulus on the prime. All right, and there were lots of different conditions, but the two that we care the most about were, first, this control condition, where here there was no overlap, right, between the prime display and the probe display. So we used totally different categories here versus here. Right? And then the critical condition was this ignored repetition condition, right, where the distractor from the prime ended up being the thing that you had to respond to on the probe. Make sense? Okay. All right, so our analysis strategy, as I said before, had two parts. And so the first part was to apply classifiers to patterns of EEG data collected during the prime display here. All right, and the goal here was to see whether we could train the classifiers to read out the category of the prime target stimulus. Right, so that's the red-tinted thing. Could we figure out, based on EEG data, the category of the thing that they were supposed to attend to? All right, that's step one. Right, and then step two was to take the classifiers that we trained to recognize the category of the target stimulus and use these to read out how much subjects were processing the prime distractor stimulus, right, the grayscale thing. So the idea is that we could get a classifier that's an expert in detecting when you're processing faces, and then we could apply it to a trial like this one, right? And use it to get a readout for that trial of how much you're processing the thing that you're supposed to be ignoring, right? And then we can use this readout of distractor activity to predict reaction times to the probe stimulus. We always did training and testing on different parts of the data set. Okay, we applied classifiers. Wait, I already said that. Separate classifiers were used for each category, right? So we trained up one set of classifiers to be face experts. And so they were trained to discriminate between trials where face was on screen as the target versus trials where face wasn't on screen at all. All right, and then we did the same for all four categories, right? So you notice that during this phase of training, we never, so for example, this classifier here was never trained on trials where the face was on screen as a distractor. All right, so those are going to be totally novel to that particular classifier. All right, so details, we recorded EEG from 77 electrodes. We spectrally decomposed the EEG time series into wavelet power coefficients at 49 frequencies. And then the wavelet time series were downsampled into 20 millisecond time bins, right? So each trial, we recorded data from a 1,000 millisecond period, so that gives us 50 of these 20 millisecond time bins. So all this comes down to the idea that for classification purposes, for a particular trial, the features that we were using as the basis for classification were defined by the crossing of 77 electrodes by 49 frequencies by 50 time bins. We used univariate feature selection here, so we discarded features that did not individually discriminate between the conditions of interest in the training set. And we used ridge regression classifiers, and we trained a separate classifier for each time bin. And so the idea here is this is allowing for the possibility that the pattern of activity associated with face processing might differ depending on where you are in the trial post-stimulus onset. Okay. So the first question is, how well could we classify the category of the thing that subjects were supposed to be attending to? All right, and so this graph shows the results. The y-axis here is classification accuracy, which we indexed using area under the ROC. Right, so 0.5 is chance. Anything better than 0.5 is better than chance. And then this is the classifier's accuracy at different time points post-stimulus onset. Right, and so these dots indicate time points that were significant. So we can just say that we're well above chance at detecting the category of the thing that subjects were supposed to attend to. We break down these results by the different categories. We can see we're best at detecting faces, next best at detecting houses, and somewhat worse at detecting shoes and chairs, but somewhat better than chance in both cases. Okay, so now we're moving to a more interesting question, which is, can we use these classifiers that we train to detect the target category to also detect the distractor category, right? So what we did to index distractor sensitivity is to compute the average activity of the classifier when a category is the distractor versus when it's not present, okay? And also as a manipulation check, we varied the strength of the distractor, the contrast of the grayscale stimulus on screen. Right, so we have these weak distractor trials where the grayscale stimulus was kind of faint, and then these strong distractor trials where the grayscale stimulus was a little bit stronger. Okay, and so what we hope to see is that the classifier's readout of distractor activity would be higher in the strong distractor condition than the weak distractor condition. All right, and so this is showing the overall accuracy across categories in detecting the distractor category, and again, here we're well above chance. Not as good as we were at detecting the category of the thing that people were supposed to be attending to, but still well above chance. And we can break it down by the different categories. Again, we're best for face and house, less good for shoe and chair, but still above chance for all four categories. Okay, and this is the manipulation check, and it just basically says that we're better at detecting the distractor when it's more salient on screen than when it's less salient, which is what we'd hope to get. Okay, so that's all setting the stage for the main analysis, where we're going to try to use this readout of distractor processing to predict subjects' reaction times, right? So just to review the predictions I said earlier, the claim is that if the distractor doesn't activate, nothing should happen, right? You shouldn't get faster or slower. If the distractor activates but loses, so if it activates a little, right, then the theory says it should get weakened and you should be slow to respond to it over here. And if it wins, the theory says it should be stronger and you should be fast to respond to it. So if we just map these conditions onto sort of overall levels of distractor activity, basically, the theory makes this prediction that the relationship between distractor activity and subsequent reaction time should be non-monotonic, right? So if it activates a little, you should be slower, but then if it activates a lot, you should be faster. Okay, right, so the key prediction is negative priming effect, the slowdown in reaction time, should be largest for moderate levels of distractor processing. Okay, and so to test this, we split our trials into quartiles based on the amount of distractor activity on that particular trial. All right, and then we computed the priming effect as a function of distractor activity. Right, so basically we're looking at reaction time here as a function of how much face activated right here. Okay, so here are the results, right? And the most important thing to take away from this graph, so over here on the x-axis, we have how much did the distractor activate, right? Not so much, a lot, sort of medium amount, right? And then over here, we have reaction time, right? And so we plotted this as the priming effect. So how much did your reaction time change from baseline as a function of distractor activation? And this is exactly what we were hoping to see. Right, so there's this non-monotonic pattern where subjects were slowest to respond to distractors. They were slowest to respond on the probe if the distractor had activated moderately during the prime. Okay, I think that actually, in the interest of time and given the proclivities of this audience, I'll skip ahead of some of these controls, which were just meant to indicate that the effect really had to do something with priming, right, and wasn't some sort of general attentional effect. Okay. Anyway, so suffice it to say that when we did the right controls and cleaned up the results a little, it actually enhanced the pattern, right? And this is pretty much exactly what we were hoping to see. Okay, so just to summarize this, the results from the study support our hypothesis that moderate activation of a neural representation leads to weakening of that representation, which is manifested in slower responding to that stimulus later. Okay. And the critical point here is that sorting trials by distractor activation allowed us to isolate a very large, robust negative priming effect, right? So if we don't look at distractor activation, if this were a purely behavioral experiment, right, the negative priming effect across all trials would be small and barely significant, all right? It would be exactly one of these equivocal effects that people are always finding with negative priming. But if we look in the activation bin, right, that we believed because of our theory would give us a big negative priming effect, we got a very large, very significant negative priming effect. All right, so I'll skip that stuff down there. One little methodological point is that in the study, right, we don't have any intrinsic interest in my lab in faces, houses, or shoes, or chairs. Right, we chose them for this experiment because we knew from prior studies that these were highly classifiable cognitive states, and so we're using them as a kind of contrast dye to improve temporal resolution. Right. So because we know that faces are highly detectable in patterns of brain activity, right, the idea is that when we use a face as a distractor, that's going to have a noticeable neural correlate that we can pick up. Okay, so moving on to the second case study, looking at this problem of memory search. Right, this is a very fundamental question in memories. If there's some event that we want to recall or some detail we want to pull up from our past, how do we dig around in memory to find this detail? And so I think there's a very useful analogy you can draw with web search, right? So if you have a web page you're looking for, right, whether or not you get that web page is a function of whether you type the right search terms into Google, right? So it might be that the web page exists, but you're just not finding it because you're not typing in the right search terms. And the exact same thing applies to memory, right? So you might have a memory in your head, right? But you're just not finding it because you're not prodding and cueing memory in the right way. And then, you know, someone might give you the perfect cue and you might remember something that you thought you completely forgot. All right. And so one of the lessons that memory researchers have gleaned from decades of memory research is that an enormous portion of the variance in what you retrieve depends on how you probe memory. Right. And so the goal of the work that I'm going to describe is to try to read out the information that subjects are using to probe memory and relate it to their behavior. And so what I'm going to give you guys is a quick overview of the task that we used to study memory search, and then also maybe 5-minute digression, just explaining some theories of memory research, right, which are the things we're trying to test with these studies. Okay, and then I'll present 2 fMRI studies of free recall. Right, so the task that we use in the laboratory to study memory search is this free recall paradigm. It's very simple. So basically, you give subjects a list of normally words to remember. So you show them, like, pizza, blue jay, blah, blah, blah. You might show them 15, 20 words, all right? And then you make people wait, and then you just say, tell me all the words that I presented in whatever order you'd like, right? It's called free recall because you are free to report things in any order, all right? Okay, so the key idea that underlies these theories of memory search is the idea of a drifting mental context, all right? And so the idea here is that at any particular point in time, you have a constellation of thoughts that are present in your head, right? So if this is a timeline over here, right, so at 4:16 today, right, you might be thinking, hey, I'm sitting in this faculty club room, you might be itchy, you might be ruminating over some really interesting diffusion tensor imaging talk that you heard earlier in the week. All right, so those are the thoughts that are active right now, and the idea is that the mixture of thoughts that's floating around in your head is going to change gradually over time, right? So if we progress over here to, losing that pointer. Jack Lab. Here, I'm going to hand this to Nico as a project to figure out where to press the button. I'm not really. We'll see. Where is it? Oh, thank you. All right, found it. Okay, right, so the idea is that you had this particular mixture of thoughts in your head at 4:16, but if we go over to 4:18, you're still thinking, hey, I'm sitting here in this room, but now you're not as itchy and you're not thinking about diffusion tensor imaging, and you start to think about what you're going to do for dinner. All right. Okay. And so now let's say that in this context, I start to run a free recall experiment on you guys. Right. So I show you a bunch of words one at a time. So shark, computer, rat, and then I'm going to test your memory and ask you to recall them. Right. And so one of the other important ideas is that whenever I show you one of these words that I'm going to want you to recall later, it's going to get bound up with whatever constellation of thoughts is floating in your head at that particular moment. Right, so when I show you shark, it's going to get attached to your feeling of itchiness and thinking that you're in the faculty club, and so on. All right, and so now we're getting up to 4:18, right? And so I give you the test, and I say, I want you to recall the list of words that I gave you most recently, right? And so what these theories say is that if you want to recall the list of words that I gave you most recently, right, you should cue with whatever constellation of thoughts is present in your head at the moment of test. So you think, right now I'm thinking about dinner, I'm thinking I'm in this room, what else did I learn when these thoughts were in my head? Right, and so you cue with these, and then you might say, oh, I remember when I was thinking about dinner, right, you showed me the word rat. Right, and so the next key idea is that when you remember rat, you might also remember other stuff that was in your head at the moment that I showed you rat. Right, so you might remember when I showed you rat, you were thinking about DTI, all right? And so then the next key step is that you take these retrieved contextual elements, right? So since you remembered that you were thinking about DTI, you load that up into your head, and then you cue memory with that also, right? So you say, what else did I study when I was thinking about DTI? And you go like, oh yeah, I remember hearing the word computer, right? And then you say, oh yeah, and I remember I was itchy when I heard the word computer. Right, and so you load itchy up in your head, and so in this way you can kind of swing yourself backward in time and recall items from the list. Okay, right? So I said that. Okay, and so the key idea here is that memory retrieval success depends on contextual reinstatement. So the idea is that whether or not you retrieve shark is a function of whether you can get your mindset during recall, right, to be the way it was when you encountered shark. So if you manage to load up itchy and being in the faculty club, right, that's the key to actually getting back to this specific memory. Okay, and so this framework also suggests how people can make judgments of recency, which I'll come back to later in the talk. Right, so if I ask you which was presented more recently, the word shark or the word skull, what you can do is use these words to cue for contextual information. So you could say, what was in my head when I studied shark? You remember thinking about all these things. And what was in my head when I thought about skull? You think about all these things. And then you compare these things to what you're thinking about now. All right? And so you can, you know, compute how many of these elements match. And you could say, well, shark, you know, was attached to two of the things I'm thinking about now, and skull was only attached to one. Right, so the shark context, right, is more similar to the current context, so shark probably occurred more recently. Okay, and one last thing to say with these funny diagrams is just an observation that these contextual elements here are useful in cueing memory specifically because of their temporal extent. All right, so for example, weather, right, is useful in cueing shark at test because it extends temporally to cover both shark and test. Right. And so if we had contextual representations that didn't last as long, they'd be less useful. So if I said, hey, you studied the word leaf, try to recall some more stuff. You might remember DTI, all right? But this isn't going to be useful because DTI didn't stick around long enough to get attached to any of these other words, right? So it's a kind of dead end, right? And then the flip side of this is that if you have one of these contextual threads that persists for too long, it basically gets overloaded and loses its efficacy as a memory queue, right? So a really important principle of memory retrieval is that it's a competitive process. Right? And so what that means is that a queue is going to be effective if it differentially supports some memories relative to others. But if you have a queue that's linked with uniform strength to a large set of memories, it ceases to be an effective queue for any one of those memories. So if you are thinking about the Batman movie the entire time I'm giving my talk, then everything I say is going to get linked up to this Batman contextual element, right? And so Batman isn't going to be a particularly useful specific queue for any of the specific things that I said. Okay. And so another way of sort of thinking about this idea of mental context is to make one of these context-based diagrams. So you can think about this red dot as sort of where you are at a particular point in time in your mental context space, right? And so the idea is that if I give you something to remember, right, you can deposit the memory at this point in contextual space, and then your mental context floats, and then I give you something else to remember, you deposit that memory in contextual space at that point, right, your context floats, you deposit other memories, and you keep doing this, right? And so you end up with a bunch of memories embedded at different points in contextual space. And so now I ask you to retrieve memories, and so the red dot is where you are in context space now, and then the idea is the probability of recalling any one of these memories is going to be a function of how close that memory is to your current context relative to all the other memories, right? And so if I queue memory right now, I might retrieve the memory that was encoded at this position in contextual space, and then the idea is that I retrieve that memory, and then I recenter myself mentally, all right, on that point in contextual space, and I queue memory again, and the memories that are likely to pop up are the memories that are close to this point. All right, so it's just another way of visualizing what I was doing with those timeline diagrams. Okay. So that's enough theory. The one thing I just want to say about this is I've been giving you these diagrams just to give you the gist of the theory. The theories themselves are actually instantiated in terms of explicit computational models. And so the way these models work is they operationalize context as a slowly drifting vector. And this context vector is associated with items, which are also operationalized as vectors. And they're associated bidirectionally. So items can trigger contextual retrieval and vice versa. Right? And the thing to note here is that these models generate very detailed predictions about the trajectory of the context vector, both when you encode memories and when you try to retrieve them, and the effects of contextual drift on behavior. Right? And so we can test some of these predictions by just looking at your behavioral data from free recall paradigms, but this is really indirect. Right? So if subjects don't behave as we were predicting, it's very difficult to say sort of what went wrong. Right? So we don't know exactly how or even if the person's context vector deviated from the predicted trajectory, right? And so to properly evaluate these theories, what we really want to do is develop methods for directly reading out the state of the context vector based on brain data. Okay, so that's the end of the theory digression. And so now I'm going to talk about the fMRI studies we did in memory search. The basic logic here is that we're going to present items in different contexts at study, train a classifier on study phase data to recognize the neural correlates of these specific mental contexts, right? And then we're going to measure reinstatement of these contexts at test. So I'm going to present two studies. One of them was alluded to by Francisco and Stephen this morning. So this is a study that Sean Pollan and Vaidehi Natu did in my lab in 2005. So since Francisco introduced it, I'll go through this pretty quickly. But the idea here is that subjects studied three different kinds of stimuli, faces, locations, and objects, and they actually performed different tasks on these stimuli. So for the faces, they were asked to rate how much they liked the celebrity, right? And for the location, they were asked to rate how much they'd like to visit that place. And for the objects, they were asked to rate how often you see that in the course of a week. All right. And so when we were designing the experiment, we thought of this as sort of three different mental contexts. You could be in your face encoding context, your location encoding context, or your object encoding context. Right. And then after subjects had studied 30 of each of these different kinds of items all mixed together, subjects were asked to recall items from all three categories in whatever order they want. Right, so the perfect response would be getting all 90 of these items correct. Right, and so the hypothesis is that if you want to recall a particular category, you try to reinstate the appropriate context from the study phase. So if you want to try to recall faces, you try to get yourself back into your face encoding mindset from the study phase. And so really concretely what this means is that When subjects are trying to recall faces, we hypothesize that subjects would try to make their brain state at test resemble their brain state when they were studying faces. Right? So just to put this back in diagrammatic form, you can think of partitioning context space into sort of the face context region, the location context region, the object context region. And so when subjects are studying these different stimuli, we can think that they're depositing memories at different points in the space. So if you study a couple faces, you stick them in face context space, and then studying a bunch of locations, objects, and then maybe go back to faces. All right. So then we have all these memories embedded in all these different points in context space. The goal of this study was to try to read out to a first approximation which of these broadly defined regions subjects were ferreting around in to try to pull up these memories. Right, so again, two-part analysis strategy. First part, we are feeding fMRI data from the study files into a pattern classification algorithm and trying to train the classifier to recognize the brain patterns associated with studying faces versus locations versus objects. For this study, we used a very simple neural network classifier akin to logistic regression without a hidden layer, so just a simple linear classifier. We did univariate feature selection again. Right. And so the second part of the analysis was to take the classifier we trained on study phase data and apply it to data from the recall phase, and we're going to use the classifier to track second by second how well the subject's brain state at retrieval matches their brain state when they were studying faces and locations and objects. And the prediction was that as subjects try to recall items from these different categories, the brain state should come into alignment with the brain states associated with studying these items, and this should predict their recall behavior. Okay, so this is a variant of the graph that you saw this morning. Just to orient you, these the x-axis here is time. All right, so this is from a single session, from a single subject, and then these three lines here are over time, how strongly did this person's brain state at test match their face study context, it's a blue line, location study context is the red line, and object study context is the green line. All right. Okay, and then the little blue dots and red dots and green dots are the moments at which they recalled faces, so that's the blue dots, red dots are locations, and green dots are objects. Right. And so you can see there's a very close correspondence between these lines here, right, which are neural measures. These are measures of neural reinstatement, and these little dots which indicate behavior, right, which category subjects were called from. Okay, there are a couple things to note about this. One thing we were able to say in this study was that category-specific brain activity started to emerge on average several seconds before subjects recalled items from that category. And so we were actually able to predict what category of item subjects would recall with above-chance accuracy based on data collected about 5 seconds before subjects recalled the item. So you can see it, like over here, your face is getting, you know, your brain's getting more and more facey, and then you recall a bunch of faces. And here, you have the location line rising, and then you recall a bunch of locations. And so we did an analysis in the paper, which came out in Science in 2005, to quantify this sort of early rise. I don't think it's ESP or anything like that. What you know, is probably going on the subject's head at this particular moment is they're thinking faces, you know, what faces I study, right? Trying to get their brain all face-like, and then when they succeed to a certain level, then they're going to recall faces. Okay, so I've been talking about this study for a long time and have become very sort of self-critical of it. And so one of the major shortcomings of the study is that item information was confounded with context information, right? So the face location and object activity at test might just reflect subjects thinking about the specific faces location. Basically, it might just reflect them thinking about, you know, faces, as opposed to subjects actually reinstantiating a detailed mental context from the study phase, right? So those are conceptually two different things, right? It doesn't seem fair to sort of strongly conclude that subjects had recaptured their mindset when we might just be picking up on category-specific activation at test. So the solution to this is pretty obvious, which is to design a new experiment where items are arbitrarily assigned to context. So this is a study that my grad student Greg Detra did last year. And so the stimuli here were just randomly selected concrete noun words. And so the words were randomly assigned for each subject to one of three different study contexts. Right? So for some words, they were supposed to picture throwing that item on a bonfire. Right? So I might give you the word shoe, and if it says bonfire, you're supposed to form an image in your head of throwing that shoe on a bonfire. Right? And for other items, subjects were supposed to picture carrying that thing upstairs. So I give you the word bathtub with carry upstairs, and you're supposed to picture in your head carrying a bathtub up the stairs. Right, the third context was drop out of a window. So I might give you the word broccoli, drop out of a window. You picture yourself dropping broccoli out of a window. right? I can also probably tell that a lot of you guys are thinking, you spent 2 weeks learning all these elaborate mathematical analysis methods, and then the psychologists are squandering it by having people sit in the scanner thinking about dropping broccoli out of windows. But rest assured that we had a plan with this, right? So the analysis method was exactly isomorphic to the previous study. So we're going to train the classifier on study phase data to recognize the neural correlates of performing bonfire encoding or stairs encoding or drop out of a window encoding. And then we're going to apply the classifier to data during the recall period, right, and try to measure reinstatement of these bonfire and stairs and window patterns. And so again, to link this back up to a diagram, right, we've sort of subdivided context space. There's a sort of stairway encoding context space and bonfire context space and window context space. And then during encoding, you're going to deposit memories in these different context spaces. And then during retrieval, we're going to try to use the classifier to figure out, you know, are you looking here or here or here? Okay. So here are the results from two subjects. It uses the same kind of display that I was using for the previous study. Right, so blue is reinstatement of the bonfire context, red is reinstatement of the stairs context, and green is reinstatement of the window context. And so the subject up here at the top, there is actually very good correspondence between their neural reinstatement of the different encoding contexts and what they were recalling. Right, so this was by and far away our best subject. And it turned out that the subject was a real outlier, right? And most of the other subjects didn't do nearly as well. Right, so this subject had, you know, some correspondence, just a little bit above chance, but nothing really to get excited about. And so this is a little bit disappointing, and so we thought, you know, given these results weren't so great, we decided to look more closely at data from the study phase, right? And so we ran a cross-validation analysis to assess whether the three contexts elicited discriminable neural patterns at study, right? So were we able to discriminate between study bonfire brain snapshots versus study stairs versus study window? And again, the results weren't even that great here, right? So this is, again, above chance, but much worse than we were doing in the previous experiment, all right? So again, this is a little bit disappointing, and it led us to think about what might be responsible for these, you know, sort of less than great results. And so after a lot of thinking, we came to realize that we'd sort of painted ourselves into a corner because there's a trade-off between classifiability and memory performance that I'll explain, right? So if you want really awesome classification, right, then you want subjects to think about these things we're trying to classify in really consistent ways within category, right? So the idea is that when subjects are doing bonfire encoding, right, we want them to think about, you know, have the same mental image all the time, right? So throwing the thing on the bonfire and having a poof of orange flame, right? But the problem is that if you always think about the bonfire in exactly the same way, the bonfire context cue is going to become overloaded, and this is going to mess up your memory, right? So the idea is that if you... every time that you see a word, let me just go back here. Every time that you see a word that you're supposed to encode in bonfire, you picture a little poof of orange flame, right? And you do this 50 times, you're going to have 50 of these little poof of orange flame memories in your head. They're all going to blend together, and it's going to be really difficult to pull out any one of those specific memories, right? So this is just a graphical representation of this situation. And so if we're putting all our bonfire memories right at the same location in contextual space, they're not going to be very discriminable, and it's going to be hard to pull up the individual memories. Right, and so the idea is that subjects, to some extent, they know this, right, just from their own life experience, that if you encode things in a really stereotyped, overlapping way, you get bad memory. And so subjects don't encode like this, right? They sort of vary things. So with the bonfire, they might imagine some of these things melting, some of them exploding, some of them sparking, some of them rolling off the bonfire, right? And so the idea is this heterogeneity is going to hurt classification, right? Because it means that the bonfire category encompasses a wider range of cognitive states, but it's going to help memory by preventing this situation where all your memories sort of blend into one another. Right? So it might be possible, if we really wanted to classify bonfire versus stairs versus window, if we had more training data on hand. But you could ask, is this really, you know, a worthwhile sort of enterprise? Right? So we've established that just thinking bonfire or stairs or window by itself, right, is not a good memory cue, right? So all the subjects in this experiment, right, they learned on the order of 50 words, probably more, in each of these different categories, right? So bonfire was linked with 50 things, then thinking about bonfire isn't going to get you to any particular memory, right? And it seems like if we really want, if our purpose in doing these experiments, right, is to be able to predict at a fine-grained level what people are going to recall, we need to know a lot more precisely where subjects are mentally in context space, right? So if we knew subjects were right here, right, then we might be able to predict that the subject would recall, you know, one of the two items that they remembered sort of lugging strenuously up the stairs, right? But just knowing that you're in this broad region isn't enough to really tell us what the person is going to recall, or even if they're going to recall something. Right, so one possibility is maybe we could try to train the classifier to recognize more points in the space. Right, so you could say that instead of just saying do stairs encoding or do bonfire encoding, right, we could take, you know, a large number of the stairs item and say juggle this. Right, so we could actually train the classifier to recognize all these little subpoints, all right, in these context spaces, and you know, got excited about that for about 2 minutes. And they realize it still doesn't solve the problem for exactly the reason I brought up in the last slide, which is we want the classifier to be really good at detecting, you know, the mental state associated with juggling a bunch of items on the stairs. All right, we have to give the classifier a lot of instances, all right, of you know, the person juggling items on the stairs, which means we have to show the person a lot of items in the juggling and coding context, which means that, you know, if you have 50 items now that you've juggled, right, then juggling isn't going to be a good cue either. All right, so this led us to try to think about whether, you know, we could move beyond classification methods and take another approach to this problem, right? So a key claim of context models is that item representations are pretty much linked to all the other thoughts that you have active in your head at a particular point in time, right? So what we really want, right, if we want to know where you are in context space, is an efficient representation of the subject's entire cognitive state. Right? And so a naive approach would just be to use the whole brain activity vector as a proxy for the context vector. But the issue is, of course, not all, and in fact most of the variance in the bold signal, right, is not cognitively relevant. I had too many nods in that, but anyway, that says it clearly. The idea is that if we could somehow manage using techniques like the ones you guys have been talking about at the summer school to isolate the cognitively relevant part of the whole brain activity pattern, this might be a useful representation of context in the head. Another point, and this actually I think is going to loop back to the stuff that Nico was talking about in the last talk, is that we should be able to use behavioral data on context shift effects to constrain the process of finding the neural context vector. Right? So there have been a lot of studies that have looked at how interposing mental activities during the study phase affects memory. Right? So here's just our little timeline of a recall experiment. And so you can ask, what happens if in the middle of this study list, I ask you to think about how awesome it would be if you were invisible? Right? So this is actually a study that was done by Lily Sahakian in 2002. And so the idea is that if I give you a really absorbing mental activity to do right at this point in time, then you think that it's going to basically reset your context vector, right, and crowd out everything you were thinking about before you started to think about invisibility. Right? And according to our theory, if you end up resetting your context vector here, right, that's going to really mess up your memory for the stuff that happened before the reset because you don't have any threads, right, that you could use to refine those items. Okay, so the idea is that you can run a bunch of experiments like this, and people have, right, and you can rank mental activities in terms of how much they disrupt recall, and we can use this to infer how much these activities disrupt context. So it turns out thinking about invisibility is a great way to mess up context. Drawing a map of your childhood home in your head messes up context, but maybe doing simple arithmetic doesn't mess up context all that much. Right? So the idea is that you can get a ranking in terms of behavior of how much any interposed mental activity pushes along your context vector. Right? And so you could say that what we really want from the neural context vector is that if there's a behavioral manipulation that's known to have a large effect on context, it should have a large effect on the neural context vector, right? And if we have a behavioral manipulation that's known to have a small effect on context, it should have a small effect on the neural context vector, right? And so you can really think about these things in terms of simple distance matrices, right? So the idea is that you have a bunch of neural distances, right, that you can actually measure from the brain for a candidate context vector, and then you have a bunch of behavioral data indicating how much these things actually messed up context. And the sign of a good context vector is when the neural distance vector is isomorphic to behavioral data on how much your recall got messed up. Anyway, that's just an idea. Another idea, and so this is I think one of the last that I'll talk about, is to focus more on the medial temporal lobe. So we know just from you know, many decades of research into memory that the medial temporal lobes, that's where in the brain you actually do the episodic binding of item and context, right? And so we know based on this that if medial temporal lobe structures are going to do this binding, they actually need both the item representation and the context representation. And so instead of looking at the whole brain, it should be possible to do high-resolution imaging of medial temporal lobes, and that would be a way of focusing in on a small structure that's likely to be very information-rich with regard to this context stuff. Right, so you could say, why don't we just try using a pattern of activity from the medial temporal lobes as the context vector, maybe doing other things to highlight cognitive variance. But it turns out, and this is a pretty amazing thing, that Joe Manns and Mark Howard and Howard Eichenbaum actually ran a rat physiology study last year that basically embodied exactly this idea. And so what they did in the study is they showed rats a series of odors, right? So they had rats sniff in this bin and sniff an odor, and then they sniffed in this bin, right? So in each trial, the rat marched around and sniffed five different odors in succession, and then the rat was trained to choose the, so they got these two little bins here on the test, and they're supposed to choose whichever bin contained the odor that occurred first in the list. Right, so it was a rat version of the recency judgment task that I showed you guys before. Okay, and then what they did is they recorded multi-unit activity from CA1 using a bunch of tetrodes, and then the cool thing is they just said, what would happen if we treat this multi-unit CA1 recording as the neural context vector? Right, and so what they did is they measured how much this CA1 pattern drifts during the encoding phase. Right, so how much the pattern of neural firing in CA1 changes from here to here to here to here within the trial, right? And the intuition is that if this is really, you know, something akin to the context vector, you should be able to use this to predict accuracy. So intuitively, the more the context vector drifts between items, the more temporally discriminable the items will be, and the better the rat will do, right? And so this slide just shows some examples of this drift in the pattern of CA1 activity. And so each row on this figure corresponds to a particular trial in the experiment. And so this column corresponds to the pattern of activity for this trial across all these different CA1 units for the first odor they sniffed, the third, and the fifth. All right, and they measured using Mihalanobis distance, right, how much the pattern changed from the first to the third odor and from the first to the fifth odor. Right, and so the main thing to take away from this is, in fact, the amount of drift in the CA1 pattern is proportional to elapsed time. Right, so there was more drift from the first to the fifth odor than from the first to the third odor. Right, so that's already a good sign that this is measuring something akin to what we want from the context vector. And then this graph is actually a little bit hard to interpret. It's easier to just take my word for it that the analysis worked. Right, so on a trial-by-trial basis, increased contextual drift between items, right? So increased difference in the pattern of CA1 activity predict increased accuracy. All right, so that's the kind of result that makes me hopeful that with appropriate signal-to-noise, we could do this kind of contextual drift analysis using human neuroimaging. Okay, so just to summarize the memory search stuff, right, there's a huge scientific payoff if we can figure out how to image subjects' mental context and how it evolves during encoding retrieval. I mean, I think it would really be a revolutionary thing for memory research if we could look at someone's brain and say, hey, this person deposited these six memories at these locations in context space, and then during retrieval, we can see their mental state zipping around and digging up these items, right? It would be meaningful from a theoretical perspective in the sense that we can test the predictions of these mathematical models about the trajectory of the context vector, and even just from a practical perspective, right? So if you have a patient that presents with memory disorders, the critical question is, you know, which of many things has gone wrong, right? Did they not encode the memories properly, right? Or is it more of a strategic problem where they have, you know, viable n-grams in their head for all these different items, but they're just not digging around properly. They're not using the right search algorithm. And at this point in time, we really, you know, don't have the tools to say, but if we could track the trajectory of the context vector, we could. And so what I said is that classification methods provide some insight into memory search, but the amount of information that we can glean is limited. And the information that we got, for example, using the face location object study, the bonfire study, was really not specific enough to test our very specific mathematical models of memory research. Okay, so the overall summary is that we can use these classifier methods to track time varying cognitive states, and we actually had a lot of success with this sort of proto-paradigm of training on well-defined cognitive states and generalizing to messy cognitive states. This is possibly the most important practical thing that I can convey to you guys, is that for example, you could try running the analysis where you train on part of the messy data, right, and then try to generalize to the rest of the messy data. And in our experience, that's never worked, right? So we've always done better when we've actually set aside a specific part of the experiment where we tried to generate really clean examples of the cognitive states of interest and use that to train the classifier. Okay, and that's just reiterating the stuff I did. And just to say, the problem that got my lab into the classification business, memory search, right, I said it's proved to be interestingly resistant to standard classification methods. Part of it is this idea that we need to track subjects' position in a very high-dimensional mental space. But I just wanted to highlight that high-dimensional by itself is not a problem if the dimensions are well-defined, right? So earlier on today, well, I guess we didn't actually mention the study yet today. So this is a very notable study from Tom Mitchell's lab. I was sure that someone would mention it. But basically, they showed that they were able to decode what word subjects were thinking of. So this came out in Science a couple months ago. And the way they did this was by representing each word in a 25-dimensional semantic feature space. Right? So based on patterns of word co-occurrence data, they generated this 25-dimensional semantic feature vector for each word, and then they basically learned the brain patterns associated with each of these 25 dimensions. Right? So that worked well, and there was this study, which we definitely did mention earlier. So this is from Jack Gallant's group. They were able to decode what photo subjects were thinking of by representing photos in terms of low-level visual features and then learning the brain patterns associated with these low-level visual features. Right? So these are all examples, very impressive examples of high-dimensional neural encoding. But this approach is harder to apply to memory search because the dimensions of the contextual search space are not always apparent beforehand. And there are also these weird issues where if you try to train up a classifier on something, you sort of invalidate it as a memory cube. So anyway, the point is this is really, I just had the urge to air dirty laundry today. So this is all of our dirty laundry. We have a lot of work left to do, but I think that, you know, the payoff is so huge that it's worth pursuing. So I just want to thank my lab. This is Aaron Newman, who did the negative priming study, Greg Detra, who did the bonfire study, and then I also want to thank Sean Pollan, who's a former member of my lab, who's going to be starting a faculty job at Vanderbilt, and Vaida Inatu, who's in the audience here, who did the face location object study. And everyone did my promotional, or not everyone, but at least two people earlier today did my promotional work for me of mentioning that we have this set of MATLAB routines that we've developed for doing these kinds of analyses, and they're freely downloadable, and we're very interested to get your feedback on how they work for you. Okay, thanks. That was a simplification of the diagrams, right? So empirically, what you find, you can make these really interesting plots that basically say, like, if you recall the fourth item that you studied, right, what are the odds that the next item you recall is going to be the fifth or the third or the sixth or the second, and you see that it proceeds in both directions, right? And actually, the mathematical instantiations of these models predict that things proceed in both directions, too, and the reason why is, A, it's probabilistic, right? And B, I don't know, it's actually a little bit complicated, but both empirically and in the detailed instantiation of the theories, the recalls go both ways.